Potential, Not Pathology, embracing creative and resourceful approaches to psychotherapy with author and therapist, Dr. Paul J. Leslie.
Welcome to Potential, Not Pathology, where we offer information and inspiration for mental health therapists who are interested in learning and applying unique therapeutic techniques and concepts into their work. With a focus on the potential each client brings to his or her therapy session, this program examines ideas and tools which can assist your clients on their journey toward healing. In this episode, we get to chat with Dr. Robert McNeely. Rob McNeely is a very dear friend of mine and an amazing practitioner in the field of psychotherapy and clinical hypnosis. Rob began his work as a medical doctor and gravitated to psychotherapy and hypnotherapy after he studied extensively with Dr. Melton Erickson. Rob founded and runs the Center for Effective Therapy in Tasmania and Australia, and he has got so many wonderful ideas that I think we can pull from. What I really enjoy talking about with Rob in this episode is the idea about how important expectancy is, instilling that in our clients, but also in the therapist, the expectancy that change will occur. Also, the importance of creating relationships and the crucial and powerful aspect of truly listening. Listening not just for ways to use techniques, but listening for the essence of the other person. Listening for ways we can help that person find new resources that they can utilize to create change in their life. And something that we were all taught, but a few of us really feel comfortable doing sometimes, is being genuine. Being completely genuine in our therapeutic relationships. Because as Rob describes, we don't always have to have our clients like us as people, but at least there's a sort of respect that we are actually being authentic and genuine with them that creates a deeper level of empathy than just surface commentary and technical expertise. So I hope you enjoy this episode with Dr. Robert McNeely, and check out his website for upcoming trainings and online programs, which I highly recommend. Dr. Rob McNeely, welcome to Potential Not Pathology.
Thanks for the invitation, Paul. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
Likewise, and I want to thank you again. We did absolutely fascinating interview about a month ago that was lost to cyberland. I kind of feel bad for people who missed it, because we had such a good interview, and then when it was time to download, and there was a whole bunch of comedy of errors. So I want to thank you for coming back and chatting with me again. For those who don't know you or might not be familiar with your work, could you tell us a little bit about what brought you to the field of therapy, particularly from a medical background?
Yeah, sure. I was in medical practice in Melbourne, Australia for 10 years, doing what GPs do, you know, delivering babies, looking after families and so on. And I noticed that there was an increasing number of people with some kind of problems that I just didn't know what to do with. People would come, they couldn't sleep, or they felt anxious or something. And with my very limited learning, I had about 10 minutes in a busy practice to decide whether to prescribe Valium or Triptanol. I mean, and that's pretty, not, it's so embarrassing to look back now. So I became interested in what I could learn to be more useful to these people. And also, like a lot of us, I had a personal challenge. My first marriage was in crisis, or I was in a crisis about my first marriage. And I saw Melbourne therapist Ainsley Mears, who talked about meditation, and it was so helpful to me. I thought, now this is something worth learning about. And I tracked him down and discovered that he'd written a textbook about medical hypnosis. Mm-hmm. And hypnosis was like, you know, I don't know about this kind of weird stuff. But I found out about it and did a 2-year training program in Melbourne. where I learned about the classical approach to hypnosis. You know, look at the spot, relax your feet, go deeper and deeper. You'll do what I tell you. You're going to be cured. You won't do this, you will do that. And while there was some good results from that, some people actually were helped by that. A lot of people weren't. And there was a lot of discontent in me about the power structure. Like, I'm the expert, I know, and if you don't do what I ask, there's something wrong with you, you're resistant. But anyhow, I stumbled across Milton Erickson's work, and that was really the beginning of a whole different direction. I saw a video of him, a film as it was in those days, for Herb Lustig's Artistry of Milton H. Erickson. A classic, just a wonderful, wonderful film, video these days. And in that, I saw Erickson talking with two people, patients or clients, if you like, but he was treating them like human beings. It was like he was a human being with these human beings, and that was revolutionary for me, and I was really taken with that approach. And I think it was love at first sight, really. You know, I think I fell in love with that man, and he's been dead for nearly 40 years, but I still love the fellow very dearly. I'm so grateful to him. And that changed the way my practice was. I left general practice, medical practice, and started up my own hypnotherapy practice. And then a few years later, I started running interest evenings for other people who wanted to find out about this. And that evolved into teaching. And I've had a marvelous time sharing what I learned from Erickson, my own particular version, to people all around the world, from Scandinavia, from Asia, from the US, Australia, Europe, all over the place. And you probably know that Ericksonian joke. How many Ericksonian therapists does it take to change a light globe?
How many?
It takes 19. One to change the light globe, and 18 to each say how they think Erickson would have done it differently. So there's a whole lot of people out there who say Erickson did this, Erickson was like that. And when you read about people's understanding of Erickson, what they write and what they say is more a function of them than of Erickson.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just another one of the 18. I'm not the one that's changing light glow. So and my mission with this is to help to offer an easy, down to earth beginning to hypnosis and to Erickson's approach in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Some people were critical of what he did in that he was so creative and so innovative and so flexible that it's easy to look and say, oh my goodness, I couldn't do that. So, and I had that experience myself first off.
Mm-hmm.
It was overwhelming. I can never do that, so I can't even start. So what I like to do is to have a way of beginning,
mm-hmm.
so that people can start to find an easy, down-to-earth connection with hypnosis and with what Erickson was doing and solutions and all the things that you know about and you do in your work.
Mm-hmm.
And to have a way of starting that so that people can get a start. And then they can evolve and explore and do what mm-hmm. they will in their own way, in their own time.
Mm-hmm. You know, as you're saying that, I'm kind of thinking that there is a lot of, in the field of therapy, but specifically in the field of hypnotherapy, there's a lot of the gurus, you know, kind of the, I even hate to frame it this way, but the cultish kind of thing. And just, I mean, from knowing you, but then based on what you just said, it's almost like you're just there to kind of open the door.
Yep.
And the person has to go through the door, because you're right. Every first student, you know, people who train directly with Erickson, whether it's you, Bill O'Hanlon, Eric Greenleaf, Gilligan, every one of you do it differently. Sure. You have a similarity, but you do it differently. So yeah. You're kind of eliminating that need to have the guru complex. Just here it is, and and then fly with it.
I don't know whether you know the Swami Beyond Ananda.
I have heard of him. Yeah,
you heard of him. He said guru, G-U-R-U. So I think that in a way speaks to the commonality between the very diverse people that work with Erickson. Uh-huh. That commonality is a respect for individuals.
Right.
An appreciation that every person has more abilities than they realize. Mm-hmm. And to have a focus of our work, not so much as defining and categorizing people, but totally opposite of that, looking at who this person is, who is this individual, where are their hidden strengths, where are their capacities that they've got out of touch with that we can help them connect with. Mm-hmm. And so, as you say, people who learnt with Erickson have got their own ways. Sid Rosen, for example, with that beautiful book, My Voice Will Go With You, mm-hmm. beautiful book, was interested in the therapeutic stories, the teaching tales.
Right.
Sid's interested in stories. Ernie Rossi has a background in Jungian analysis. Mm-hmm. So he's very interested in the intrapsychic, so that's Ernie. And each person provides an individual perspective. Mm-hmm. But there was only one Ericksonian, and he's been dead for nearly, like I say, nearly 40 years now. So mm-hmm. we can't channel him. But who was it said, when I point to the moon, don't look at my finger?
Yeah.
And I think Erickson pointed to some things, and a lot of people have looked at his finger.
Yeah, I agree.
Missed the point.
I agree with that. I also find it interesting when you brought up the idea of how each person and treating each person as an individual when it comes to the client, but also what we bring as an individual to our interactions. You know, our mutual friend Scott Miller's research over and over and over has shown it still goes back to the relationship.
Yep.
And so when you think about interaction with clients and that important element of relationship, how do you kind of, what's your mindset when you approach a new client?
Well, this is a very active conversation for me, Paul, because I'm in the middle of writing a book. I'm calling it Just Do Good Work, because that's what Erickson said to me, just do good work.
Right.
And the question there is, how do you do good work? What is that? Mm-hmm. And inspired by Scott, I'm a fan of Scott's work. I mm-hmm. really appreciate what he's doing. And I like him as a person. I think he's on a mission. Mm-hmm. Like the Blues Brothers. He's on a mission.
And, mission from God.
Mission from God. Well, he has a background in that, but we won't go into that. But, for me, I have a similar parallel emphasis that for me, the two crucial things are the therapeutic relationship and the mood of expectancy. Mm-hmm. And I think as therapists, whatever the field, however we're working, whether we're psychodynamic, doing EMDR, hypnosis, gestalt, whatever. Those two factors are crucial and often overlooked. Often we go to workshops to find out techniques. Mm-hmm. And we've all been to workshops and seen people like you say, gurus, and you think, I'm going to try that technique. Mm-hmm. Now, Sir William Osler said 200 years ago that he always told his students, to use any new drug as much as possible when it first came out while it was still useful. You know, there are fads in therapy. Mm-hmm. They come and they go. EMDR was it. Now it's part of it. CBT was it. And thank mm-hmm. goodness that wave is passing too. not that it's bad, but it's so I think that for me, one of the biggest contributions we can make is our mode of expectancy. Now, Erickson said that you can be walking along the street, minding your own business, and suddenly, out of nowhere, you've got a problem. So why can't you be walking down the street, minding your own business, and for no good reason, that problem disappears? And in fact, that is our experience. We can have a problem, and sometimes, oh, hang on, it just goes. So I think as therapists, we can contribute to that, because when a client comes with a problem, they always bring a mood of resignation. Always. Clients always, anytime you or I or any of us have a problem, it's never felt like, oh, I've got this problem and I know that at any moment it's going to go. That's not a problem.
Right.
It's just a circumstance. It's a little glitch. So if a client comes with resignation and we kind of feel that, that kind of heaviness, we can pick up their mood of resignation and we can feel heavy. We can feel resigned. We can feel burdened. We can feel limited. If you like, using a hypnotic metaphor, clients can put us into a bad trance.
Yes.
And all that happens then is at the end of the session, the clients hypnotize us into seeing how hopeless their situation is. It's not really helpful to anyone. But if we can start with our own mood of expectancy, I wonder what's going to happen here. I wonder how this can happen. I wonder what you're going to discover. I wonder when you're going to discover. How are you going to know? All those kinds of ways of expressing it. But more than the expression, the mood of expectancy, if we can have that mood of expectancy, the client has a chance of picking up our mood. And it also inoculates us against picking up their mood of resignation. So everybody everybody wins. And expectancy is something that's not unfamiliar to anyone. We know what it's like when a holiday's coming, when someone's, the kid's waiting for Christmas, or, you know, we know that. It's a human. And I think that therapists could contribute a lot to the effectiveness of their work by learning and doing some, to use Scott Miller's phrase, to use some deliberate practice generating expectancy. So that's the first thing, expectancy. I think it's, for me, it's number one.
Right.
And secondly, the therapeutic relationship. Well, how do we do that? How do we generate a relationship? I mean, this is not rocket science. You know, if I were to talk to you now, listen, Paul, I've got an answer for you. Just do it what I say. I'm the expert. And just, if you're very lucky, you'll get a little bit of this and maybe it'll help you. But you're pretty stupid. So I'm not sure that you're nowhere near as intelligent as me. I'm not sure that it's going to be. I mean, that's one way of what? I wouldn't call that a very helpful relationship.
I don't think so.
Wouldn't work for me. Wouldn't work for me.
Sounds like being married to me, but that's okay.
Well, my Irish ancestors, anyone who tries to tell me what to do, they've got to fight to the death.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
someone invites me to do something, well, you know, usually I'm pretty easy. So I think if we start, and all of these things are interrelated, if we start by respecting the legitimacy of every person's position and experience, no matter how weird it might seem to us, no matter how unacceptable it might seem to us, if we start with accepting the legitimacy of their experience at the moment, then there's a possibility of a connection.
Right.
And then when there's a connection, then, you know, there's some trust. Then the client starts to think, oh, this person's not going to try and force me or fix me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this other person is kind of a decent human being. Then we can start to, for me, it's just common sense that if you're going to work with someone, or if you're going to get your car fixed or your computer fixed, you don't just want a technician. You know, you find out who is this person.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was living in Melbourne, we had a man who used to look after my car. And my son found out about him too. And he would drive from one side of Melbourne to the other, you know, like drive for an hour, go to this man, because he could trust him.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
this man would say, he said to my son one time, there was something wrong with the car, and my son thought, and this man, this mechanic said, don't worry about it. There's nothing to do. I could do a whole lot of things, but we don't need to do anything. I mean, is that, it's like a gem.
Mm-hmm.
Find someone who is going to be straight and honest and clear rather than someone on the make.
Right.
So I think that's how we are in life. And the same with therapists. People are not stupid.
Mm-hmm.
The clients come and the first thing they do is they check us out, like, who is this person? You know, are they all right, or can we trust them, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that if we are respectful,
right,
accepting, flexible, and then comes the most marvelous part of all of this process of listening.
Mm-hmm.
We all know listening is key.
Yes.
But what is it? How do we do it?
So much of, you think back to the great Carl Rogers, so much of his was just that presence of listening and yes. giving that space.
Yes.
And we all want that space, don't we?
We do. The experience of being in the presence of someone who is listening is sometimes, it's always healing. Sometimes it's curative. Sometimes that's all someone wants.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's not. But it's a necessary component for anything that's effective. And by the way, if you look at Erickson's work, mm-hmm. you'll see that he was an excellent listener. He used to use the word observing.
Mm-hmm.
But he observed not only with his eyes, but his ears and his experience in his gut and so on. But the way Erickson listened, he didn't listen for people to like him.
Mm-hmm.
Some people hated him.
Yeah.
there was a man who came to Jay Haley for therapy. He was having a problem with his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And Haley was working with him and found out that this man had had a problem with his elder daughter and had seen Erickson. And so Haley said to him, how come Erickson helped you with your first daughter? How come he didn't go back there?
Mm-hmm.
And the man said, I'm not going back to that man, not after what he did to me. He said, he wouldn't let me leave the house for a whole week. I'm not going back to see him. He was really incensed about that. And Haley discovered then when Erickson was touring, doing lectures, he would stay as a guest in this man's house. So there was a lot of respect, but people didn't necessarily like it.
Right, right.
And I think there's a muddle there. I think a lot of us like to be liked.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that's listening to our need and not listening to the client.
Right, right. Yeah, and I found that the people who have, whether they're just in general or specifically therapists, who have this perception of need that I need to be approved of and liked by my client, rarely have either of those.
Yep.
It's like the ones who doesn't, you're just being genuine, even like you say, you know, I kind of, this guy, that he, I don't like him, but I mean, I'll let him stay in my house because I know he's effective. So you get that. It's like a paradox, you know?
Yeah. It's a paradox, and it's also common sense, like a lot of paradoxes, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
In the first international conference, Paul, back in 1980, there was a wonderful therapist there, William Hanley, who was down from Canada. He was such a delight, so flexible and so warm and so helpful. He was a lovely human being, and I think my guess is that he was also a very good therapist. Anyhow, at the end of the conference, we were sitting at the bus stop waiting for to get back to the airport, and here he is, this flexible man sitting with a grey suit, a pale grey shirt, a slightly darker grey tie, grey socks and black shoes. He was dressed like an undertaker. And I said to him, William, how come with all your flexibility, you dress so conservatively? And he said, I like to keep a low profile. He said, then if someone is rabbiting on and on and on and on, and we're not getting anywhere, from my low profile, I can just say, oh, shit. And that comment coming out of someone with a low profile is much more dramatic than someone who is kind of, you know, out there.
Yeah. Well, you've kind of built your practice around not just hypnosis, but you've been really one of the early proponents in your country of a solution-oriented approaches.
Oh, yeah.
What do you think, after all these years, is the most important thing about helping, because you're not giving them the solution, you're kind of helping them find their own solutions. What do you think the most important thing is about setting the frame of therapy to be solution-oriented?
Well, let me make a parallel comment before I get to that. One of the real kind of situations that gets me murderous, you know, I'm a fairly peaceful person. But there are some things that I get, like I want to kill people. Mm-hmm. And the areas that really get me going is when someone in a position of authority says to someone, you are incurable. You are not going to get over this. You know, like with your work with hoodoo.
Mm-hmm.
Some people who have the authority and experts put the root on someone. They curse someone.
Right.
And they don't listen for what's possible with someone. They listen for a diagnosis, and then they are condemned for the rest of their life.
Mm-hmm.
So I mention that because that's one of my motivations. That's the mood that I come from, partly because I see the benefit of looking for solutions, but also because I see the downside of people who look for pathology.
Right.
I mean, the name of your podcast.
Mm-hmm. Hmm? Yeah, potential, not pathology, right. Yeah.
So we're brothers about this, but there's so much pathologizing happens.
Mm-hmm.
It's natural. It's understandable. But for me, it's totally unacceptable. And so that motivates me to speak about this and to invite other people to look at this.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, when we look at what is the most useful, the central parts of the solution orientation, I think they're no different from what we were speaking about before.
Mm-hmm.
The whole basis of the solution orientation is that solutions are possible.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when Erickson started that 50 years ago, it was revolutionary. People thought he was an idiot.
Yeah.
You know, what's wrong with him? He's got no theory. He didn't have a theory. He had he held the space of possibility. And he held it like the dogged Scandinavian he was. You know, Ericsson is a Norwegian name.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether you know Scandinavian. I mean, Scott's got a Swedish background. You know, don't mess with him. don't muck around with the people from that area of the world. You just, you know, the Vikings, you know,
right.
So I think that holding that possibility, Ericsson said at one point that he had a phone call from someone, a woman, one of my favorite stories about him, who'd been obsessively washing her hands for 12 years. And he told me he was very interested to find out what she used to do with her hands 13 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was interested to help her to connect with a lifetime of washing her hands normally instead of putting the focus on the obsession. So I think that that notion of possibility, of expectancy, and for us to hold that is mm-hmm. one of the most appealing and most useful contributions that the solution approach has,
mm-hmm.
offers.
Mm-hmm.
And also the relationship.
Right.
You know, I'm not the expert. I'm asking questions. Steve DeShazer was a fan of Ericsson's and used to call him Ericsson the Clever. And after a while, he realized he was never going to reach that. He was never going to be another Ericsson. So mm-hmm. he decided he was going to be Steve the Stupid. And from the position of Steve the Stupid, he could ask questions.
Right.
Now, Scott's work, you know, he was part of that.
Right, yeah.
Part of the Milwaukee Center. And it's not that the solution orientation is better than other approaches. But for me, there's something about the solution orientation that gives us a clue about where to put our attention and mm-hmm. how, what to practice deliberately and how we can be, even if we don't do solution-oriented work, but by being, making the client the expert, by listening, by listening for resources, not pathology, listening for mm-hmm. potential, not pathology, mm-hmm. listening to the client instead of our theory, listening
right.
to what might be useful in the future rather than listening for what caused the situation in the past. All of those fundamental components of the solution approach, even though the approach itself is not superior, I think it points to some areas that we can all benefit by practicing, by exploring, and contribute to our individual way of working with clients so that we can do better work.
Right, right. And because some things that we think are problems, I guess technically they're problems, but they're unfortunate aspects of life. And sometimes just, you know, examining what resources we have to deal with that. An example I had recently is a gentleman whose wife has Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no cure for that. I mean, the fact of the matter is just real blunt, her brain is dying.
Yep.
So I can't cure that problem. But he and I sat down is how can we make her time while she's
exactly.
here?
Exactly.
More enjoyable, and you know, as she declines, how can we find the joy and the humor? And to me, that's, you know, that's dealing with it's not really a problem. It's a fact of life, and so it moved from a problem to a fact of life. And here's some resources. He loves music, so he introduced a lot of music to to his wife. Which, as an aside, I've done some interesting research on that, and that actually helps with the cognitions and have music and movement. So, I think sometimes we get so hung up with want to help people solve things that we can't solve, that we forget the relationship, that we forget the interaction. We rush in with a technique to you know, to change the world. And I don't know if that's always realistic, you know.
But it's Oscar Wilde said that about a woman who was very, very attentive to all of her friends' problems. And he said, you could tell by the haunted looks on their faces. You know, if someone is out there beating to do good, they're terrifying. And I think dangerous. Even, you know, you say you've done some research about music. People say, oh, okay, music is a technique. Oh, whenever there's something, I'm going to play some music. But there's music in music. If you put on Bach for some people, it's going to be different from putting on heavy metal.
Right.
They're both music.
Uh-huh.
If you put me in front of had me listen to some heavy metal, I'd probably need to increase my medication, you know. And some people, if you put Bach on, they'll say, oh, this is rubbish, you know. I mean,
right. So
even in that, even with the use of music as a technique, it's going to work when you fit the music to the client.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And for some people, if they like heavy metal, great.
Mm-hmm.
If I hate it and they like it, that's my problem.
Yeah.
that's for me to deal with.
Right. Yeah.
Very nice. But to not dilute your point that a problem is a problem is a problem.
Yeah.
And actually, we can say that any problem is simply a situation that we don't like.
Right.
That we don't want. Bill O'Hanlon says there's no such thing as a weed. I mean, a weed is just a plant that happens to be in a place that we don't want it.
Right, yeah.
We say it's a problem, but it's actually a plant.
Yeah.
So when you help this man to see that his wife's Alzheimer's, that the situation is how it is.
Right.
Then you can start to explore. One of my teachers, Werner Erhard, put it beautifully. I don't know whether you know Werner, who did S training and that.
Yeah.
So, anyhow, Werner said, obviously, the truth is what's so. It's not so obvious, but it's also so what? And not so what, like, you know, don't worry about it, but okay, this woman's got Alzheimer's. Yes, so? What can we do about it?
Right.
So it's Erickson's principle. You accept what the client brings and you make use of it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't try and change it. You don't try and alter it. You don't try and fix it. You accept it. You make use of it. There was a woman who had bad migraines, wanted help from Erickson. And towards the end of their time, he said to her, make sure you don't lose migraines totally. Because sometimes a migraine is the only legitimate excuse for not going to a family gathering that you don't want to go to. he was quite radical, and the way that he accepted the legitimacy of anyone's situation and then tried to find a way of making use of it was very inspiring.
Yeah, absolutely. And I still find if I read something, an old case, I still get inspired by his work. A little aside, I have an intern right now at our practice, and she told me that one of her professors was just very anti-Milton Erickson and thought he was a snake oil salesman and all of that, which elicited nothing but hearty laughter for me. So I had to make sure. I said, I think what I told her is like, well, don't tell her you're training with me. You know, I want you to get through this program, you know. Yeah. But, you know, it's funny because it's like things come full circle, because when Erickson came out, I mean, they probably thought he was the patient rather than the therapist. It was so radical. And then some of his ideas become accepted and then expanded upon by MRI and Steve DeShazer, et cetera. And everybody's coming. And then it's like it seems it's disappeared a little bit. I'm hoping it's kind of coming back. It's like the cycle we have where we – and maybe it's as the tide of pathology rolls in and then it rolls back out. Yep. But I'm kind of feeling, I don't know about your thoughts, but I'm kind of feeling like we're about to have another tide rolling in of potential-oriented therapy and client strengths and all of that. Do you agree with that?
I do. And I think Scott is at the forefront of that with his quantifying things. Mm-hmm. And the managed care approach with all of its limitations mm-hmm. is putting a focus on effectiveness, on what works.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And economics are having a big influence here. If governments are spending all the amount of money that they're spending on drugs, on therapy, on all kinds of things to do with mental health, and they're not getting the results, then there's an economic pressure. It's just, common sense. If something's mm-hmm. not working, well, instead of doing more of it, maybe we could do something different. So I think right. you're right. I think there is a movement towards exploring what's useful rather than pushing, Sir William Mosler, must have been a marvelous man. He said that the greater the ignorance, the greater the fundamentalism.
Yes, yes.
So that if someone says the only way to treat depression is with drugs, fundamentally, that's it. What mm-hmm. they're doing is displaying an ignorance, and I'm not saying ignorance as an insult in any way.
Right.
I mean, ignorance just means to not know. So if someone doesn't know about anything else and all they've got is drugs, well, drugs will be it.
Mm-hmm.
And if the drugs don't work, then you increase the dose.
Mm-hmm.
If that doesn't work, you get another drug.
Right, yeah.
But surely, eventually, I'm not just talking about drugs, but in any approach, CBT, any approach, Ericksonian mm-hmm. therapy, any approach, solution-oriented
yes.
therapy,
mm-hmm.
any approach, if you're doing it with a particular client and it's not working, well, for goodness sake, let's do something else.
Mm-hmm.
If we're having a solution-oriented conversation and someone's getting worse, let's look at the pathology.
Mm-hmm.
See
sure.
what we can do there.
Mm-hmm.
But I agree with you. I think there is some light at the end of the tunnel. You know, they say, just be careful, it's not an oncoming train. But in Australia, there's a different version. You know, the light at the end of the tunnel has just been turned off due to an industrial dispute. we can be hopeful that there's something there. And I think there is some evidence. So all we can do, Paul, is and you're part of this.
Yeah.
You're part of this. You're part of giving a voice
mm-hmm.
to this movement of potential rather than just pathology.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we can all, enough of us make a small contribution, then enough of us doing that, we can shift things.
Yeah.
We can help that tendency, help it along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what I hope. I definitely.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
As we come to the end of our time together, I'd like for you to tell everybody a little bit about this new program that we were discussing right before we kind of hit record, and it's the it's the Matrix of Ericksonian Hypnosis. Can you tell us a little bit about this? And it'll be coming up in a few months from now.
Yeah.
What does that course entail?
Well, I've noticed that a lot of people go to workshops and they learn techniques they get an idea, they get theories, but when they come back to the to their clinical practice, they don't have the confidence to actually apply it. Mm-hmm. And so I believe, and I've seen evidence for this, that the useful learning happens through experience.
Right.
So in this program that I'm creating, it's going to go for 3 or 4 months, there's going to be a weekly online video conversation where I will do a demonstration and then people can practice online so that we can look at a small component of what's interesting for them to learn.
Mm-hmm.
I can demonstrate it so they can see it. Then they can practice it.
Right.
And then we can come back and discuss what happened. And by doing that recurrently, that kind of practical, deliberate practice of the components that are going to be useful, that leads to a bodily felt experience of solid confidence so that someone can then use it in their work.
Mm.
So the program is going to have a very strong emphasis on practical learning, right? And that learning will be a function of each person in the program.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a matter of me saying, I've got the answer, and if you'll ape me and copy my words, you'll be as good mm-hmm. as me.
Right.
God forbid. But from the other way, when someone learns from within themselves, that's when the learning sticks. So that's going to be the essence of the program, Paul. I'm very, very tried it last year, and people in it liked it a lot.
Good.
So I'm looking forward to that happening. If people want some details about that, that's on the website, which is just www.cet.net.au.
Okay, excellent.
And I'd always be happy to hear from someone. My email is rob@cet.net.au.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy schedule, as always, to talk to me. And I'm glad we were able to get this one done successfully.
Yes. And it's still in cyberspace, Paul.
I know. Don't speak too soon.
Let's have an expectancy.
Yes.
That is going to happen.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it. And thanks for the opportunity. And to be able to relate to you in this way with the mutual trust and with mutual respect, it's a good example of what we're talking about.
Thank you for listening to Potential Not Pathology with Dr. Paula J. Leslie. If you enjoyed the show, check out our website at potentialnotpathology.com, where you will find programs and articles showcasing unique and creative therapeutic applications.